Also, political analyst Michael Lane spoke to us from Washington, D.C., and journalist and activist Khaled Barkat, who spoke to us from Vancouver. That is for this edition of The Debate. From Ikara Tawai, the entire team is goodbye. Until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatimi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Qul in صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Our top stories: Israel once again launches airstrikes on the Syrian capital, Damascus, killing three military personnel. Secretary of State in the U.S. state of Georgia says he was pressured by Republican Senator Lindsey Graham to invalidate ballots legally cast in the presidential election. And Peru's Congress elects Francisco Sagasti as the new president in an attempt to resolve the South American country's crippling political crisis. Welcome. Our top story: Israel has carried out airstrikes on the Syrian capital, Damascus, killing three military personnel. The Israeli army said its warplanes targeted military sites belonging to resistance groups. Sources from the Syrian army said one serviceman was also injured during the aggression. Syrian media have reported that the country's air defenses intercepted a number of Israeli rockets which were fired from the occupied Golan. Israel frequently targets military positions inside Syria, especially those of the resistance groups, which have played a key role in helping the Syrian army in its fight against terrorists. Political analyst Scott Bennett believes the Israeli air raids are a provocative declaration of war on Syria.
This is certainly a provocative declaration of war, as Israel and the Zionist regime has consistently done. It's always astounding that the world has shown such deaf ears to the cries of the children and the women who are slaughtered and left in the street or buried under the rubble of the Israeli rockets and munitions and fighter plane raids. But once again, we see the true colors of a murderous, savage regime that has no morality whatsoever, no decency and no restraint, but is instead trying to capitalize, I think, on some of the political instability in the West and build upon their stabbing in the back of President Trump and then turning towards a larger war agenda against Syria and these other areas as part of their Odeh-Dinan plan. They've been doing this and planning this and exercising it since 2001, and this is just a stepping up of that.
Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has strongly condemned the Palestinian Authority's decision to restore its ties with the Israeli regime. Hamas denounced the move as a contradiction of all Palestinian values and principles and a violation of the historic agreement signed by Palestinian leaders in Beirut. It further described the PA's decision as a blow to efforts for creating national and strategic unity to counter occupation and annexation of Palestinian lands. It said the move will give an excuse to justify Arab states' normalization with Israel. Hamas called on the PA to immediately withdraw the announcement and not wager on Joe Biden's projected victory in U.S. presidential election. This comes after the Palestinian Authority said it will resume civil and security cooperation with Israel.
We received today an official letter from the Israeli regime announcing its commitment to sign agreements between Israel and the Palestine Liberation Organization. In my opinion, this letter, some would consider what I'm saying as an exaggeration, but whoever reads history would understand the importance of this letter. This is the first letter to be sent in all of Netanyahu's era.
A PA official said Biden's election campaign has rejected the so-called deal of the century proposed by the Trump administration. Palestinian authorities suspended security and civil cooperation with Israel in May after Tel Aviv announced plans to annex the Jordan Valley and the occupied West Bank. The PA argued that the move would make a two-state solution impossible. Israel has also withheld some $890 million in tax transfers from the Palestinian Authority. Employees of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees have staged a sit-in protest in the Gaza Strip to demand their full salaries. UNRWA has been struggling with financial problems after the U.S. decision in 2018 to halt funding the agency. Ashraf Shannon reports.
UNRWA employees went on partial labor strike to slam the agency's failure to pay their salaries. UNRWA has announced that workers would only receive part of their salaries for November and December due to budget deficits. The UN agency provides education, health and welfare services to millions of Palestinian refugees in the occupied West Bank, Jerusalem al-Quds, the Gaza Strip, Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan. More than 1.3 million Palestinians live in the Gaza Strip and rely on UNRWA aid to survive. With some 13,000 people on staff, UNRWA is the main employer after local authorities in the blockaded Gaza Strip, which is home to about 2 million people.
The decision to delay or pay partial salaries is a grave violation of the rights of employees. It will only increase the sufferings of the Palestinian refugees at home and abroad. This is an unprecedented situation and will have dire consequences, especially in the Gaza Strip.
UNRWA is suffering from a huge budget deficit that has forced it to cut back its services to Palestinian refugees in recent years, including the provision of urgent relief and emergencies. The Israeli regime has been campaigning to defund the UN agency in an attempt to end the refugees' right of return. The crisis worsened after US President Donald Trump decided to cancel funding to UNRWA in 2018.
The US funding for UNRWA stood about $360 million each year. So after the U.S. decision, UNRWA was forced to lay off 116 emergency employees. This is the worst budget deficit that we have been experiencing over the past years.
UNRWA is a United Nations agency established by the General Assembly decades ago and mandated to provide assistance and protection to Palestine refugees across West Asia. According to UNRWA, there are over 5 million registered Palestinian refugees.
This partial payment of salaries will have a big socio-economic impact on all UNRWA employees. All services to Palestinian refugees will be hampered because of the budget deficit, including health, education, and aid.
The plight of Palestinian refugees began in 1948 upon the creation of the Israeli regime on occupied Palestinian land.
Palestinian refugees say that UNRWA cuts will only deepen the suffering after more than 7 decades of displacement. Ashraf Sharan, Gaza.
Secretary of State in the U.S. state of Georgia says Republican Senator Lindsey Graham has urged him to find a way to toss out legal ballots cast in the recent presidential election.
Senator Graham applied for us to audit the envelopes and then throw out the ballots for counties who had the highest frequency error of signatures. And that I tried to, you know, help explain that that's because we did signature match, you couldn't tie the signatures back anymore, you know, to those ballots. We got off the call and I said I would circle back and I talked to council and I get back to them. And we just decided the best action was not to, you know, get back and re-engage.
Irregularities. Graham disputed those comments, saying he has only called for toughening voter ID laws. Post-election chaos in the U.S. continues amid President Donald Trump's claims of voter fraud. On Tuesday, he sacked the country's top cybersecurity official. Chris Krebs had confirmed that the presidential election was highly secure. Meanwhile, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court has rejected the Trump campaign's lawsuit regarding election observation in the city of Philadelphia. The lawsuit was one of several suits the Trump campaign filed in key states where his Democratic rival Joe Biden was projected the winner. Colin Campbell says there are a lot of disturbing implications from the actions of U.S. President Donald Trump during the recent weeks.
Yeah, there's a guy who was a director in the Department of Homeland Security, and the president now got rid of him. This is the latest in a series of firings over the past week after his loss in the general presidential election of 2020, a much-anticipated election, and many would argue one of the most consequential elections in recent American history. So this is, some would say, is out of anger that he lost the election, and we do see Krebs as a very pivotal person in all of this, one who has defended the integrity of the election as the president has alleged voter fraud, not just voter fraud, but rampant voter fraud across the nation, telling his supporters, many of whom made up about 70 million Americans, that there was voter fraud in various states, which is why he lost the election. There are a lot of disturbing implications from what the president is doing, and the response, or lack of response, rather, from Republicans is quite concerning, some would say, frankly, disturbing.
The U.S. says it will withdraw thousands of its troops from Afghanistan and Iraq within the next 2 months.
By January 15th, 2021, our forces their size in Afghanistan will be 2,500 troops. Our force size in Iraq will also be 2,500 by that same date. This is consistent with our established plans and strategic objectives, supported by the American people, and does not equate to a change in U.S. policy or objectives.
The United States currently has some 3,000 troops stationed in Iraq and nearly 4,500 in Afghanistan. The decision to partially cut forces contradicts earlier remarks by Donald Trump saying all American forces in the two countries would be back home by Christmas. Meanwhile, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell slammed the decision, saying a sharp reduction of American troops in Iraq or Afghanistan would be a mistake. Author and commentator Media Benjamin believes the U.S. should pull all its troops out of Iraq and Afghanistan instead of withdrawing only some of them.
What the discussion should be is that why is he only taking out a small number of the troops and leaving 5,000 behind instead of fulfilling his promise, as you said, that the troops would be home by Christmas? Instead, the discussion from both the Democrat and Republican sides of the aisle is, why is he bringing these troops out now without a plan? And this is a bad idea. What can we do about this? Pulling their hair out, trying to see how they can stop this. It's really crazy because the American people have shown in poll after poll, left, right, Republican, Democrat, Independent, they're tired of these wars. That's why it was to the advantage of Donald Trump to campaign on bringing the troops home. But somehow, once people get into Congress, they change their stripes and they become part of the military-industrial congressional complex.
In other news, Peru's Congress has sworn in Francisco Sagasti as the country's interim president in a bid to defuse a crippling political crisis. The 76-year-old centrist politician has become the third Peruvian president in a week. Latin American nation has been grappling with a political crisis since the ouster of President Martin Vizcarra by the Congress earlier this month. His removal triggered weeks of often violent protests, which left the two young people dead. Actually, two young people, Vizcarra's successor, Manuel Moreno, resigned on Sunday after just 5 days in office. The caretaker president will serve until July of next year, with a new presidential election scheduled for April. Sagasti is yet to name his cabinet, but has said he is open to including ministers from Vizcarra's government. Well, COVID-19 cases in Europe surpass 15 million as several countries report record number of infections and deaths. Britain reported nearly 600 new daily deaths, its highest toll since May. Over 20,000 new confirmed cases of the virus were also reported in the UK. Britain has so far recorded more than 52,000 deaths out of some 1.4 million infections. The overall number of COVID-19 cases in France surpassed 2 million, while the country reported 437 new deaths. Daily infections in Italy have jumped to over 32,000. The country also reported 731 deaths, which is the highest daily toll since early April. Russia registered a record high number of 442 fatalities, pushing its total to nearly 34,000. Now, a report by the Italian Pediatric Society has found that over 1 in every 10 COVID-19 cases recorded so far in the country are children or teenagers. This is while the number of coronavirus-related deaths has reached the most, or I should say the highest, in the country since April. Max Civilli is in Rome.
A latest report by the Italian Pediatric Society has highlighted that 12% of COVID-19 infections, or 126,000 cases, regarded children or teenagers. The study, based on monitoring data from the Higher Health Institute, has found that over 36,000 were under 10, while around 90,000 were in the 10 to 19 age group. The report stressed that the fatality rate was extremely low and that the vast majority only manifested minor clinical forms of COVID-19.
A study carried out by Rome's University of La Sapienza has found that in some Italian regions, the number of infant deaths at birth tripled during the lockdown months. This is due to the fact that most health checks were cancelled or postponed.
The most likely reason behind this is that many mothers-to-be did not attend medical checks for fears of being infected with COVID-19. We monitored the number of newborns in all Lazio's region's hospitals in March, April and May, and we noted a new significant drop compared to the same period last year.
The study has also found that the number of premature newborns went down considerably during the lockdown months compared to the year before.
This is a positive data point which has to be associated to the fact that mothers-to-be were in mandatory time off due to the COVID-19 restrictions. The most important message from this report is that pregnant women must continue to attend medical checks to prevent neonatal complications.
Meanwhile, Italy's hospitals are facing overwhelming pressure from the coronavirus pandemic. Health authorities fear that there will be more COVID-19 patients in need of intensive care by the last week of November than during the spring peak. Max Civili, Rome.
European Union lawmakers demand governments in the 27-nation bloc make healthcare cooperation a number one priority in light of the many failings exposed by the COVID-19 pandemic. Our Brussels correspondent, Jerome Hughes, has the details of the European Parliament's debate on the issue.
With two COVID-19 vaccines almost certainly on the way, members of the European Parliament, MEPs, are expressing hope. However, some of the EU legislators remain sceptical. Trust is a big issue, they say. One MEP highlights how Pfizer CEO Albert Bourla last week sold $5.6 million worth of shares he had in the firm shortly after announcing the pharmaceutical had developed a vaccine.
I think Pfizer needs to clarify this a bit more to really give us a good, solid working base with the pharmaceutical industry.
During an online debate coordinated from the European Parliament Brussels, lawmakers raised concerns about EU hospitals being unable to cope, medication shortages, and the ability of EU nations to distribute a vaccine in a coordinated fashion.
The COVID-19 pandemic has been a big tragedy for the world and for the EU countries, and it shows clearly that we need to cooperate more on the health level.
As millions of people across the EU endure a second lockdown, legislators are concerned that domestic violence is again on the rise. Experts confirm it is a problem throughout every EU member state.
In one, the figures are a bit higher than the others, but even in the country which would show lowest, it's still one in every five women who's a victim of sexual or physical violence.
Lawmakers were urged during the debate to support proposals put forward by the European Commission last week to establish an EU health union so that the bloc can be better prepared for the next crisis.
Citizens saying, where is the EU? Why can it not do more? And I think this is the time when we need to stand up to our responsibilities.
In the wake of the 2008 economic crash, the EU began working on a banking union. That process is still in train. It's a new policy area that provides little confidence a so-called health union can be established anytime soon. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
COVID-19 deaths in the U.S. have surpassed 248,000 as the country struggles to contain the outbreak. According to Johns Hopkins University's tally, the U.S. Total confirmed cases have also topped 11.3 million. The surge in COVID-19 cases and deaths comes as experts in the U.S. say disputes in the presidential election could worsen the pandemic. U.S. projected President-elect Joe Biden's COVID-19 task force has warned that the federal government's delay in recognizing his victory could be compromising the country's response to the virus. They said the task force's experts had not been able to discuss the pandemic with current administration officials or access real-time data. President Donald Trump has been in hot water for his lackluster response to the coronavirus outbreak. That's your world news for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate, praise belongs to Allah who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Limelight. Crawling for prey at more than 1,000 feet under the surface, the scalloped hammerhead shark relies on a special oil in its liver to survive the crushing pressures of the deep sea. Shark liver oil, or squalene, is a fatty substance that provides vital buoyancy for this critically endangered species and many others. But it's also a lifesaver for humans as a boosting agent in vaccines called an adjuvant, and improves the immune system and make vaccines more effective. Stay with us for an article penned by Justin Meneguzzi, a commentator and writer, under the heading Why a COVID-19 Vaccine Could Further Imperil Deep Sea Sharks. Stay with us for more of Justin Meneguzzi's article. As the world's pharmaceutical companies scramble to create a vaccine for COVID-19, at least 5 of the 202 vaccine candidates rely on shark liver oil, or squalene, sourced from wild caught sharks. One candidate is a vaccine developed in Australia by the University of Queensland in partnership with the Australian biopharmaceutical company CSL and its subsidiary Seqirus. The as-yet-unnamed vaccine contains the squalene adjuvant, MF59, which is sourced from a variety of shark species. It entered human clinical trials earlier this year, and if successful, will result in an initial production of 51 million doses. Tens of millions of sharks are caught and traded internationally each year, both legally and illegally, the majority for their meat and fins, but roughly 3 million or more for their squalene, or shark liver oil. It takes the livers of between 2,500 and 3,000 sharks to extract about a ton of squalene. Conservationists fear that increased demand for shark liver oil or squalene for vaccines, among other uses, could further imperil shark species, a third of which are vulnerable to extinction. Stephanie Brendel, founder and executive director of Shark Allies, a conservation non-profit organization, says this is an unsustainable demand to place on a finite natural resource like sharks. Only about 1% of shark liver oil or squalene ends up in vaccines, and most goes into cosmetics such as sunscreens, skin creams, and moisturizers. Even so, as the global population booms, the need for vaccines will only increase in the coming years. Stephanie Brendel notes, adding that some medical experts suggest that people will require multiple doses of vaccines against COVID-19. Stephanie Brendel adds, "We're not saying that vaccine trials should stop, but if we keep viewing sharks as an easy solution and don't consider the alternatives that exist, then we'll just continue to use squalene as a template for vaccines." In light of the declining shark population, some biotechnology companies are looking for other sources of shark liver oil or squalene. Plants such as sugarcane, olives, amaranth seeds, and rice bran, for instance, all contain the substance. While plant-based alternatives are being tested in studies and clinical trials, regulatory agencies such as the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA, have yet to approve them as part of a final vaccine product. For centuries, people have exploited shark liver oil for food and energy. Liver oil, for example, fueled streetlights across 18th century Europe. The oil has also long been used in textiles and food coloring, as well as cosmetic products. but it wasn't until 1997 that Chiron, a former biotechnology company that's since been acquired by Novartis, used squalene as an adjuvant in the Fluad influenza vaccine. Other major pharmaceutical companies began to rely on squalene for their seasonal flu and swine flu vaccines. While the overwhelming majority of sharks are unintentionally caught by large-scale fisheries pursuing tuna, squid and salmon, deficiencies in reporting mean it is difficult to disentangle legitimate bycatch from illegal fishing activities. The species of shark being traded is also rarely identified in trade records. To meet the demand for shark liver oil, a specialized industry of fishermen, producers and traders have developed, especially in Indonesia and in India. In a process dubbed livering, fishermen kill a shark to remove its liver, then throw the rest of the carcass overboard. In processing centers on land, the livers are minced, boiled, and placed in tanks, where they are put in a centrifuge to separate the oil from any residue. The shark liver oil is then packaged and shipped around the world. 1 ton of shark liver oil could be worth thousands of dollars, depending on its squalene content. In a 2014 report, the non-profit organization Wildlife Risk described a factory in southeastern China that was illegally processing 600 whale sharks, a protected species, and basking sharks a year. Though all sharks have squalene, fishermen target deep-sea species, which have the biggest livers and thus the highest concentrations of the oil. These sharks are especially vulnerable to overfishing because they mature slowly. Some take a decade to begin reproducing. As a result, nearly half of the 60 shark species most wanted for their livers, including the scalloped hammerhead shark, the long-fin mako shark, and the whale shark, are considered vulnerable to extinction by the International Union for Conservation of Nature, IUCN, the body that sets the conservation status of wild animals and plants. Many of those species are protected under the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora, or CITES, which restricts or bans fishing of certain marine species such as sharks and rays. Joanne Cleary, a spokesperson for Sequirus, which uses the squalene adjuvant MF59, told National Geographic that their squalene is sourced from shark species that aren't protected under CITES. In a follow-up request, Joanne Cleary did not say whether Sequirus suppliers meet sustainable fishing standards set by the Marine Stewardship Council. According to Stephanie Brendel of Shark Allies, just because a fishery avoids protected species doesn't mean it's sustainable. Only a handful of species are legally protected, and getting a new one onto protection list takes years. Losing top marine predators such as the scalloped hammerhead shark could be disastrous for the environment, according to Austin Gallagher, a National Geographic explorer and chief scientist at Beneath the Waves, a Virginia-based shark conservation group. Sharks play a crucial role as the natural white blood cells of our oceans, Gallagher says. They keep our ecosystems robust by eating other animals that are sick, injured, or not fit to pass on their genes. They're agents of natural selection in the most poetic way. We'll be right back. Stephanie Brendel, founder and executive director of Shark Allies, a conservation and non-profit organization, says the onus is on pharmaceutical companies to begin developing viable alternatives to shark squalene to present to regulators. She points out that Novavax, a vaccine development company, is already using an alternative squalene adjuvant, Matrix-M, in clinical trials for its experimental COVID-19 vaccine. Matrix-M is made from bark of the soapbark tree, which is abundant in Chile. Cleary, the Seqirus spokesperson, says that at this stage, alternative squalenes have not been approved by regulators for use in vaccines due to the purity levels required. However, the Infectious Disease Research Institute found that pharmaceutical-grade squalene produced by a biotechnology company, Amyris, met and in some cases exceeded the safety and purity profiles of shark-based squalene, according to Chris Padden, Amyris's lead scientist. Amyris is banking on sugarcane as a solution to shark-based squalene, he says. In southeastern Brazil, the company is growing thousands of acres of bamboo-like sugarcane to be processed into squalene. Just 24 acres of sugarcane could, in theory, produce enough squalene to support 1 billion COVID-19 vaccines. Because growers can't control the way sugarcane is grown and harvested, it's possible to ensure the quality of the squalene, Padden says. When you use animal products, there are impurities that come with them because of the environment they're raised in and the places where they're processed. Furthermore, Padden says, growing sugarcane is also cheaper than catching sharks and removing their livers. Beneath the waves, Gallagher adds, the pandemic has heightened public scrutiny of the vaccine development process and exactly what goes into our medicines. One of the other significant things that also has come out of this pandemic, he says, has been simply shining a light on the greater environmental issue at hand here, which is the significant loss of sharks from our oceans that is happening on a global scale.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Julian Assange extradition hearing has been dubbed by many observers and those who care to report on it as the trial of the century. I was there at the Old Bailey in London, and I witnessed firsthand the hearing unfold. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. The United States is charging Australian journalist and WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange with 17 counts under the Espionage Act, each carrying with it a maximum sentence of 10 years and an additional count under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, carrying with it a maximum sentence of 5 years. If Julian Assange is extradited to the United States, he faces up to 175 years in a maximum security prison. All of this for the crime of journalism. The successful prosecution of a journalist under the Espionage Act is unprecedented. If convicted, this will have grave ramifications and far-reaching implications for journalism worldwide. On the morning of September 7th, 2020, Julian Assange was rearrested in his jail cell just as his hearing was set to resume at the Old Bailey in London. He hadn't seen his lawyers for 6 months due to COVID restrictions, and communication with them was extremely limited, making it virtually impossible to coordinate any sort of defense. Julian Assange's defense team made it very clear to Judge Baretzer the obstacles that Julian was presented with this entire lockdown. They asked her for more time, that she adjourn the hearing until January 2021 so that he could build a better defense, even though this meant more time in solitary confinement for Julian Assange. She refused the request and proceeded anyway with the hearing, even though it was based off of a new superseding indictment submitted by the United States prosecution. This superseding indictment was given after the deadline and after Assange's defense team had already submitted their evidence and defense arguments. So even though these were the same 18 counts, this superseding indictment had only one goal, which was to make Julian Assange look more sinister and nefarious, so that if he were to be extradited, this would lead to far harsher sentencing in a US court. Now, there's no denying that if Julian Assange is extradited to the United States, he will almost certainly be found guilty, not because he did anything wrong, but because he faces an absolutely unfair trial. The indictment against Julian Assange was returned by a federal grand jury at the Eastern District Court of Virginia, which is also known as the Espionage Court. This is the place where all indictments are cooked up and served to journalists and whistleblowers and people that the United States seeks to make an example of, such as Chelsea Manning or Gary McKinnon or Lori Love. Moreover, the jury that will try Assange in this show trial will be made up predominantly of people from the US intelligence community, including the CIA and the NSA and the Department of Defense. And they will most certainly convict him because he committed the unforgivable sin, which was to expose the United States and their war crimes, their torture programs, and show the US empire for what it is, a bloodthirsty machine that goes around the planet kidnapping and torturing and killing people. One of the media partners that helped expose these crimes is Iraq Body Count. I spoke earlier with Josh Dougherty, who's a senior analyst and researcher from Iraq Body Count, about the impact of these files.
You know, usually with mass graves, they found the number in Iraq during the war, but it was usually dozens, hundreds. So 15,000 would be, you know, like hundreds of mass graves. So to have that sort of reveal at one time in a collection of hundreds of thousands of documents is really huge.
The cables that you worked on with WikiLeaks, the Iraq war logs, how did they affect the perception of the Iraq war in the public sphere, in the public eye?
It turned sentiment away from the war, in terms of against the war, but I think that was already happening to quite a large extent over the years as it got worse and worse in the 2004, 5, 6, 7. You know, sentiment turned away. And then I think that the war logs kind of just solidified that again.
It is extremely evident, just by the very nature of the files that WikiLeaks published and the crimes that Julian Assange exposed, that his persecution is purely political. Julian Assange is being charged under the Espionage Act, which since its very inception has always been a political tool designed to silence political dissidents. It was used against Eugene Debs, a presidential candidate who spoke out against the First World War and the draft. He was stripped of his citizenship and jailed for 10 years. It was used against Daniel Ellsberg, who worked on the Pentagon Papers. It's used arbitrarily against journalists and others who go against the U.S. empire. We mustn't forget that until his arrest in 2019, Julian Assange, when he was dragged out of the Ecuadorian embassy in London by the Metropolitan Police, his only crime in the UK was jumping bail. Within 15 minutes, a judge declared him guilty and sent him to spend 50 weeks, the maximum sentence, in Her Majesty's prison, Belmarsh. This is a Category A maximum security prison where only terrorists and the worst of the worst are sent. That alone tells you everything you need to know. He was given the maximum sentence so that the United States Department of Justice would have ample time to prepare this indictment against him. And surely enough, it came. In court, we heard stark reminders how several officials from the Trump administration have publicly commented about how they want to go after Julian Assange, not because he actually committed any crimes, but because this is a political witch hunt. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in 2017 said that WikiLeaks was a, quote, non-state hostile intelligence service. Former Attorney General Jeff Sessions clearly pressured the Eastern District Court of Virginia to serve this indictment against Assange. And Donald Trump himself has gone back and forth and flip-flopped on his story regarding Assange. In 2010, he said Assange deserves the death penalty. Then in 2016, he said, I love WikiLeaks. And then in 2019, he said he doesn't know anything about WikiLeaks and he's never heard of it. At one point, Judge Baretzer even inquired whether the U.S. presidential elections on November 3rd would impact the case and said that she would only give a final ruling after the elections. She inadvertently admitted that the trial is political. We mustn't forget that Julian Assange is an Australian citizen in the United Kingdom. He is not American, he has never committed a crime in the U.S., and he does not owe anything to the U.S. Nonetheless, the United States is reaching its tentacles all the way across the Atlantic and trying to kidnap a journalist it does not like because he exposed their war crimes. So while they're charging him under U.S. law, they're also denying him any privileges and rights under U.S. law. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said that Julian Assange has no First Amendment rights because he's all the way in London. So why are they going after him if he's all the way in London? As I said in my statement outside the Old Bailey, this might be the City of London. The court might be physically located in the UK, but it is the United States that is holding the gavel. And let it be noted how on the very first day, over 40 human rights organizations and observers and NGOs and MEPs had their access revoked to the trial so that we could not watch what was happening inside of this hearing. During the extradition hearing, we had a total of 47 expert witnesses that were called to the stand. Three of them were called by the prosecution, but all the rest were called by the defense. So every time someone would take the stand, we'd see the same pattern from the prosecution. James Lewis, QC, who was heading the prosecution, would come and ask if they had been paid to testify on Assange's behalf. He would then cite public comments or even petitions that they had signed or open letters as proof that they were somehow biased in Assange's favor. Then we would see the prosecution try to attack the expertise of these witnesses and their respective fields. Highly embarrassing moments, which pointed out how hollow the entire case being put forward by the prosecution really was. And then all of a sudden the judge, Judge Baretta, says that we're out of time and she wants to rush through all of the witnesses. And so this culminated in seeing the defense having to scramble to summarize witness statements into written form instead of having witnesses come and testify and read them out as fast as possible so that they may be submitted into the record. You must remember that the witnesses were also lumped with hundreds of documents, sometimes 24 hours before they were set to testify by the prosecution. This was a dirty tactic among many used by the prosecution. You know, at first they would argue that Julian Assange was somehow not a journalist. And then they would argue that even if Julian Assange is a journalist, there's no law preventing them from prosecuting journalists, just brazenly trying to make this point. Then, of course, it came to the issue of Julian Assange's mental and physical health. You see, this was a necessary evil because although these were highly personal matters, his defense had to argue this in court because under Section 91 of the Extradition Act, one can block an extradition if it poses a significant risk to the defendant's physical and mental health. And of course, the prosecution attempted to refute all the diagnoses. They attempted to say that Julian Assange does not have Asperger's and that if he does have depression, well, it's a mild depression, not a moderate or a severe one. They tried to downplay the great risk of suicide that an extradition would pose. And then, of course, when it came to the special administrative measures, these inhumane, draconian conditions that are nothing short of torture, they tried to downplay these SAMs. You see, Julian Assange will be subjected to these extremely draconian and harsh conditions before he's even convicted of a crime. And he could spend years in pretrial at Alexandria Detention Center. conditions that are so harsh they drove Chelsea Manning to attempt suicide. And if convicted, he will almost certainly be sent to ADX Florence in Colorado, which is a federal super maximum prison. And we don't even have to wait for Julian Assange to be taken to the U.S. to be tortured, because he's already in solitary confinement 23 hours a day in Belmarsh Prison, which the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture described as the following. He said Julian Assange showed all the symptoms typical for prolonged exposure to psychological torture. Right now, Julian Assange is freezing with no heating in his jail cell. Every single day before he was set to appear at the hearing at the Old Bailey, he would be stripped naked and searched and x-rayed and then transported in an upright coffin to the courthouse, an hour and a half and an hour and a half on the way back, every single day. Is that how a civilized nation and a democracy treats journalists now? Perhaps the most explosive witness testimony that we heard throughout this entire hearing came on day 17, when we heard from two former employees of UC Global. UC Global is the Spanish firm that was hired to originally protect the Ecuadorian embassy, but then ended up working for the US intelligence services and spying on Julian Assange and every single person who dared to even visit him or walk through the doors of the embassy, dismantling the phones of journalists, photographing their passports, and violating their privacy like you would not believe. They also discussed a plot to kidnap and poison Assange and make it look like an accident. They even recorded these conversations with his lawyers, violating his legal privilege, which is enshrined in Article 8 of the European Convention on Human Rights, which violates his right to due process under US law, which violates British common law, which violates the fundamental principles of any legal system. But moreover, they took all his personal effects when he was arrested in April of 2019, meaning that any trial Julian Assange would face in the United States is already tainted and using tainted evidence and should be thrown out by any judge with a shred of integrity. I was sitting in court right next to Fidel Narvaez, the former consul to the Ecuadorian embassy, when we heard from these former employees of UC Global.
Those testimonies in particular I am very familiar with, because I am basically a witness in the criminal case that's taking place in Madrid against UC Global. So I have previously seen, and I had access to plenty of evidence of the espionage, of the spying, in terms of videos, audios, documents, and all sorts of activities, illegal activities taking place in my embassy. But personally, what impacted me most and what should have a lot of importance in this proceedings, I think, are the medical reports on Julian, the diagnosis that has been carried out by the highest specialist in the UK regarding his condition, his basically the risk of suicide if he is extradited and subject to those inhuman conditions that we know for sure are the conditions in the supermax prisons in the US system.
These witness statements from UC Global, we only heard about them on day 17 towards the end of the hearing. Do you feel that they got enough attention in court? And also, do you feel that they got enough attention in the media?
No, they didn't get the attention that they deserve. Not at all. It was pity that we couldn't have the witnesses giving testimony, live testimony on camera, because that would have more impact. And they didn't have the attention that they deserve in media as well, because basically this is a political case, and I think the main playing field is outside the court, is public opinion, is what the establishment in the UK decides to do in order to put pressure on the judge, or in order to stop the extradition or to extradite him. This is going to be decided outside. That's my opinion. So even if the testimonies had attention in court, The more important thing is that they are covered by the public opinion, that the media report on them, and that doesn't happen.
Fidel, how optimistic are you about Judge Barretzer's ruling?